Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 18th of October, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, mulling over some of the construction-related news stories from the past couple of weeks. And if there were a theme to this week's conversation, Phil, I suppose you would say that it was infrastructure and politics. Would I be right?
I think so, yes.
Pretty much, because, I mean, we were talking last time we were on the last podcast. We were talking about Rishi Sunak, and because of course it was a Tory party conference.
Cancellation of HS2 Northern Leg was the
cancellation of cancellation of HS2, and yeah, all the rest of it. And of course, last week it was Keir Starmer's turn, and this week, I mean, we'll talk about Keir Starmer in a minute, but this week we've also had John Armitt wading into the discussion because, of course, his outfit, the Infrastructure Commission, has just released its second report, and he's got some interesting things to say about that. But I think we'll come on to that in a little while, shall we? Shall we get Starmer out of the way first?
Yes, as you said, 2 weeks ago we were talking about cancellation of HS2 and Sunak going back on some of the net zero timetable of things, mm-hmm. Petrol car bans and things like that. And I suggested, wrongly as it happens, that he might get a bit of a positive bounce in the polls on the back of that. In fact, it's not happened. And the voting intentions, I had a look at the poll of polls, voting intentions are barely unchanged. Labour Party is still anywhere between 50 and 20 points ahead, depending on what you look at. And Sunak's own personal ratings has fallen quite substantially in the past month or so, in the period in which he's been making these headline-grabbing announcements, which seem to row back on various policies and ways. Some have suggested he's starting to show slight populist tendencies, rowing back against the established consensus. And then, as you mentioned, Labour Party conference last week, 10th of October, Keir Starmer gave a speech. And I suppose we should read this in conjunction with the speech that Rachel Reeves gave the day before. She's the Shadow Chancellor. I think, just read that Mark Carney, the Canadian former Governor of the Bank of England, has come out and basically endorsed her and said she'd be the best Chancellor that the UK could have right now, which is quite a surprising intervention by even a former Governor of the Bank of England. But she's a credible person. But these two speeches in conjunction, we've heard them say it before, but they really, really pushed it. We are the builders, not the blockers. Build, build, build. Yeah. The word build appears 26 times in Rachel Reeves' speech. And in Keir Starmer's speech the following day, appears 21 times. I mean, the real theme of it, more particularly, he was saying, we're going to unleash the big build, talking about new towns and building on the green belt, although we're going to protect the green belt. We're only going to build on the scuzzy bits of the green belt, to which some people said,
the grey belt, I believe.
He says that.
The grey belt.
But then some of the environmentalists saying, "Hang on, that's where all the best newts are. All the interesting wildlife is in the grey belt." So wherever you try and build, there's going to be problems. And he says, "We're determined to fight the blockers who hold a veto over British aspiration. No more land bankers sitting comfortably on brownfield sites while rents in the community rise." Blah blah blah. Good stuff. It's a great signal for the construction industry. Will it happen? Yeah. He is going to have exactly the same real life problems that every government's ever had. NIMBYs like you and me who don't want their, you know, beautiful villages turned into new towns. Thank you very much. And we want it built somewhere else. And there'll be environmental constraints. I mean, he says that he's going to put lots more money into local authority planning departments to get planning applications through and cut the tape there. Where's that money come from? I mean, It could happen. The important thing is that he sees it as an issue on which to fight the election. It's firmly on the agenda of everyone, basically, I think.
You said the we're NIMBYs. You might very well be right. I think Starmer describes himself as a YIMBY, doesn't he? Yes, in my backyard. But, yeah. I don't know if he actually said that in that speech there, but I mean, I'm sure I've heard him say it before, that, you know, there's this reluctance to build on, you know, especially in perhaps Tory constituencies to...
But he lives in Camden. Landscape. I think he'd have a different perspective if he lived in North Devon, yeah. David.
Probably. Although I have to say, and I've probably mentioned this in the past, that I actually am sitting right next door to a brownfield site. It's an old tannery yard, which hasn't actually... It's just been derelict for the past 50 years. No, 60 years, I think. And people want to build on it, but nothing ever happens. They've got permission for, I think, 5 houses, but it's just not going to happen. It just... Anyway, so that's beside the point. That's a bit of an aside, but I think there's a lot to like in what Starmer said, and maybe that's the whole idea. I mean, after all, party conferences are all about grandstanding, so he's going to say a lot of stuff that's going to hit the right note. But I think brownfield land. I mean, he says brownfield land can provide room for 1.2 million new homes, and I think he's probably right. Going back to a previous Labour administration, I can remember John Prescott, remember, Deputy Prime Minister. He was all for building on brownfield sites and sort of urban infill and all that sort of stuff. And it was great. Everybody thought it was a great idea, and talked about sort of increasing sort of population density in the cities and stuff like that. In fact, I think one of the architectural journals actually dubbed him Density's Child. This is a time when Beyoncé was, of course, part of a band called Destiny's Child, so it struck a chord there. Anyway, so it's a little bit like going back sort of 25 years to the Blair government. They're saying very much the same sort of things. Whether or not it happens, I don't know. He did say that getting Britain building again is our most important mission, which rather surprised me, because clearly I haven't heard him say anything quite so unequivocal in the past. And there are plenty of other things to worry about, like the NHS and the cost of living and all the rest of it. But if their most important mission is to get us building again, then clearly that's music to the ears of the construction industry.
Well, I think in many ways it's easier to get Britain building again because the projects are all there than it is to fix the NHS or to,
yes,
you know, change the education system overnight, or education outcomes, I should say, rather than the system overnight. And similarly, fixing NHS, improving education have long-term massive economic benefits. Of course they do. But if you can get Britain building again, that's a much quicker motor for the economy. That's a, you know, yeah, short and medium, but particularly short-term motor for the economy, I suppose, is how it's seen. So there is sense in putting infrastructure, construction, housing, house building right up there. I don't think he's particularly going to come out in favour of Thames Tunnel, the Lower Thames Crossing, I mean, or the Stonehenge Tunnel and road building. We've talked before, I think,
they're too contentious.
New roads are out of fashion, yeah, and Labour's, yes, not going to bring them back into fashion. I think Starmer is particularly looking at house building and associated infrastructure that supports house building.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, because he hasn't said that he's going to reverse Rishi Sunak's decision on HS2, for example. So that's... You know, it's not as if he's going to say we're going to build more high-speed rail, because he's keeping quiet on that.
Yes. I can't see how it can be reversed, to be honest, the HS2. I'm sure it'll come back in the end, eventually, in some new form or fashion. But I don't think in a year's time should the election... I mean, the next election statutorily has to be by January 2025, which is whatever that is, 14 months away. Everyone seems to think that it will be sometime in 2024, which is soon upon us. So it's a case of, will it be spring slash early summer or will it be autumn? And I think my money's on the autumn. I don't think Sunak's
yes,
in
me
any,
too.
Any great rush to go back to California quite yet.
Weather's quite nice out there. But yeah, okay. So that's Keir Starmer. And how do you think that he went down with the rest of the industry compared to what Rishi Sunak has said?
I think in general terms, he's you know, making friends and influencing people when it comes to construction industry.
Even the environmentalists seem to like what he said. CPRE, was it the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England, said some complimentary things about this because they like the brownfield idea.
Yes. Yeah. I think when it comes to the detail, they were the people who said the scrubland should be protected.
That's true. They did, didn't they? Yeah.
But no, I think, interestingly, I suppose what Sunak said has more significance. He's the man in the hot seat at the moment. But we got a lot of immediate feedback from the industry when Sunak spoke.
Yeah.
Wasn't inundated with reaction or response to Starmer because we don't yet really have the... I mean, it's all slogans, really, what Starmer's saying at the moment. It's, yes, he's saying we're going to, you know, unlock and set free and build. But until he's actually got his feet under the table and says, right, this is where and how and with what money, there's nothing to dislike, basically, if you're in the construction industry.
No, that's
it. We're saying we're going to, you know, we love you and we're going to look after you and put you first.
Yeah. Classic sort of party conference speech, though, wasn't it? Because... You don't use a speech like that to alienate people. You're going to try and embrace as many as you can. I suppose, you know, the proof is in the pudding, as always, with these things.
Although he didn't use the word brothers once, but maybe that's because it's, you know, Labour leaders in the past say brothers, but then...
Oh, yeah.
That's a... what's the word? Sexist.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah.
Comrades, that would be what they say, wouldn't it?
Comrades, they'd normally say.
No, he didn't use that word either. I've got a speech in front of me, so I'm just doing a word search on all the key things. But it wasn't written down. He may have used it in the hall. I don't know.
But both he and Sunak use the collective noun conference when they're addressing their people. So we're doing this conference. That really irritates me, actually. Yeah, we're talking to conference. I don't know what it is about it, but it sounds stupid because there's under no other circumstances would you address people collectively or singularly as conference. And maybe unless you're talking
Have you never convened a meeting in your place of work and said, now then, meeting?
No, never.
No, me neither. Like you mentioned in your intro the National Infrastructure Commission, this outfit chaired by John Armitt. And they have published just this morning 222 pages of it. And I have not had time. I mean, I've posted a couple of news items on our website this morning, but I've not had time to read all 222 pages of the thing. I've only been able to cherry pick the key recommendations, intro, conclusion, and so on. But there's a lot of stuff in here.
Yeah, there is.
For me, the key takeaways, the general one is that they are clearly annoyed at the whole point of the National Infrastructure Commission is to depoliticize infrastructure planning, say, right, this is what's in the best interest of the country. We can all agree on this, the experts say, and politicians can get behind it. And it's, for example, a high speed train line that goes from London to Birmingham to Leeds to Manchester. And so we have this plan, and then chop, 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 governments keep chopping and changing. And that's the National Infrastructure Commission exists to stop that happening. So clearly it's not working. So you might say, what's the point of the National Infrastructure Commission if it comes up with these big plans and the government goes, yep, lovely, we'll do that. And then a year later says, nope, can't do that. We're not doing that. However, I mean, it might as well be a think tank rather than an official statutory body is what I'm saying. If the Centre for Policy Studies or the whatever other think tanks are out there which produced this report, it would have just the same impact at the end of the day. It would be an important document out there. People say, yep, that's a good idea. But the government would not be held to it, as has been proven by HS2 and other things. But anyway, what it's saying has weight and is interesting and, I guess, important. And one of the things it's saying, which I think has particular weight, is it rules out the use of hydrogen for domestic heating. He says, yes. by 2035, yes, we should develop or find slash create a body to be given, you know, like a sort of a cadent for hydrogen, to develop a hydrogen network, pipe network, for industrial power, you know, Teesside type places and where there are, you know, big, heavy manufacturing and steel mills or whatever want to be powered by hydrogen. Great for that. We'll do that. Let's go down that route. But for houses, it's heat pumps only, I'm afraid. Now, here, the report slightly comes a cropper, because they say, we think that homeowners should get £7,000 grants for having a heat pump fitted. And I'm thinking, what, you think the grants should be reduced? Because actually, while this report has been at the printers, the government had come along and said, we're increasing the grants for heat pumps from £5,000 to £7,500.
I hadn't noticed. That was well spotted, Phil. I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, the National Insurance Commission is actually recommending lower grants, and the government, actually the £7,500 grant comes in next week. So they're a bit behind the curve on that. But that's a facetious point on my behalf, perhaps. But no, I thought their commitment to electricity over hydrogen for domestic heating, and they've published a separate annex making the case for this and standing by it. So that's a major point in all of this.
Yes. I mean, he covers, obviously, when you're talking about infrastructure, you're talking about a wide range of topics. But I think there was about 6 bullet points in the report. I did manage to focus on those. He talks about adding low carbon technology to the electricity infrastructure, so distribution and generation, I guess. And as you say, electrification is the only viable option for decarbonizing building, and therefore he's behind the heat pump idea. Other things I noticed were things we ought to roll out gigabit broadband, which of course is a very important bit of infrastructure. The water supply infrastructure, he says we should reduce demand and reduce the leaks, again, which will be no supply, a surprise to anybody. And also reform the waste and recycling. He said we don't recycle enough, which I thought was quite interesting. And presumably we waste too much.
That's all in the direction of travel, though. I think we could have guessed it would say, you know, let's have more motherhood and apple pie. I mean, it's all good stuff. But there's not a headline there. There's not a headline saying we should, you know, save water and we should recycle more or whatever.
No.
Whereas I think they're absolutely saying, because there had been, there are still are a lot of question marks over the viability of heat pumps, whether that's air source, ground source heat pumps,
yes,
for retrofitting to a lot of the existing housing stock. I mean, new build is only ever going to be a tiny proportion of all the houses in the country that, that people live in. And the many, many houses are completely unsuitable for heat pumps being fitted.
Yes.
I mean, the houses in my village that aren't even allowed to change the colour of their front door. So how are they going to get, you know,
But I'm sure I heard him on the radio this morning. You were probably busy writing your stories. I don't know if you listened to the Today programme on Radio 4 this morning, but he was interviewed on that. And sort of in between the cornflakes and the kettle boiling, I'm sure I heard him say that, you know, when he was talking about this, the fact that hydrogen isn't the optimum choice for, you know, hydrogen fueled boilers, not a good idea, go for heat pumps instead. And he said that, you know, if you've got a house that, you know, isn't insulated properly, or just get a bigger heat pump. And I found, if that's what he said, I was rather surprised by that. I might have misheard him, because I think that the received wisdom is that it isn't worth putting in a heat pump into a house which is leaking energy like a sieve. So if you've got a really badly insulated house, a heat pump isn't going to do it. I mean, heat pumps don't chuck out heat at the same sort of temperature or volume as a gas boiler, for example. And so in order to get the benefit, you need a house that's going to retain the heat that the heat pump does produce. And so to say that, you know, it doesn't matter if your house is a bit leaky and not very energy efficient, just put in a bigger heat pump. Interest is an interesting attitude, I thought. But I think that one of the reasons, you going back to your point about the fact that really what the National Infrastructure Commission has said in the past hasn't actually had much influence with government policy, I think there's a basic problem is that John Armitt is looking in the long term. The National Infrastructure Commission is looking for long-term solutions. And governments don't do that. Governments focus on the short term. And this is one of the problems with government policy, is it? And we've seen it just this year and in every other year previously, that policy changes very, very quickly, depending on, you know, which way the political wind is blowing. So, you know, the scrapping of HS2, for example, that was a political decision. John Armitt didn't say that they should revive HS2, but another thing he said was that the government should call a halt, don't sell off the land, the property that you compulsorily purchased for phase two of HS2. Don't sell, because this is what Rishi Sunak wants to do, sell off that land again, use the money to fund other infrastructure projects, you know, transport projects in the north, Network North, whatever they call it. And Armitt's saying, no, don't. Just leave it for a couple of years, two or three years. Something might come up. Somebody might come up and be able to use that land. And that the scrapping of phase two of HS2 was a knee-jerk reaction, and that it could result in far worse rail congestion between Birmingham and Manchester. So we're going to have a worse situation on our hands. So don't do anything drastic now. You know, just try and see what happens in the long term. But they won't see what's happening in the long term, because, as you said, within the next 14 months, we'll have a general election. It'll all change again.
But I think Armitt is kind of on a slightly sticky wicket that he doesn't address. And he put out a statement earlier this month when Sunak scrapped the Manchester leg of HS2. And he said it was highly disappointing. We had this long-term strategy with clear objectives, and it's disappointing that it's gone. But he doesn't address the fact that it had a less than one cost-benefit analysis. In other words, it had been shown by independent studies, by the same sort of people as the National Infrastructure Commission. It had been shown to be not value for money. And Sunak made that point, and Sunak made the point that it was, you know, the circumstances had changed since it was initially put forward. And Armitt's point is, no, we'd planned it. We can't change plans. And
yeah,
while I get that frustration, it does make the point, and I think the National Infrastructure Commission report today makes the point that you need to stick to plans to encourage investment, and we're going to need private investment into UK infrastructure if we're going to build what we need to build. And therefore, you have to have a temperate climate for this investment. Cancelling long-held plans, well-developed plans, is not compatible with bringing in investment, private investment. As I said before, I get that, but just because a plan's a plan doesn't mean to say you should still do it. I mean, I think in 1944, I think we had a plan to drop some bombs somewhere, but, you know, the war's over. We don't want to drop any bombs anymore in Germany, do we? We can't, that things have changed.
Not a direct comparison, but I see what you're getting at. Yeah, no, that's true. You have to, I suppose you have to adjust to changes. But I mean, we could talk about HS2 all day. As you know, I thought that it was ill-conceived in the first place, and that in actual fact, they should have pulled the plug much, much sooner. I think the timing was unfortunate there. But you know, people were sort of promoting it, keeping on, you've got to do it. And I suppose Rishi Sunak, at least he finally said when he saw the numbers, that he decided that now was the time to call a halt.
When I started out in journalism in the 1980s on New Civil Engineer magazine, the infrastructure that occupied most of our attention, most of our writing, most of our energies was roads, frankly. That's mainly what infrastructure was. There's something about railways, but apart from the Channel Tunnel, which is obviously the most sexy, exciting, biggest thing going, there wasn't a lot of railway construction going on. And railway maintenance was sort of tied up in nationalised British Rail then, so we didn't particularly, apart from the Channel Tunnel, and then subsequently the planning and construction of HS1, the Channel Tunnel rail link, as was. Mostly it was about roads, a little bit about dams and rivers and so on and so forth, and the water industry was being privatised, so that was a big issue. But I would estimate that 70% of what was in New Civil Engineer magazine in the 1970s was the motorway construction programme, local highway maintenance, and so on.
Was it Roads for the Future? Was that? John Major?
No, it was Paul Channon, I seem to remember. But maybe in the... who's a fabulous man, Paul. I don't know if it's Channon or Shannon. It's Mick Shannon, the footballer, but I sometimes heard it being described as Paul Channon, who's rather a different kettle of fish. But I think it's part of the... Was he part of the Guinness family or married into the Guinness family?
I have no idea.
But what he was so perfect at, he had the misfortune as Transport Secretary to have some horrible disasters befall on his watch. Certainly the King's Cross fire was during his time.
Right.
And I'm not sure there weren't some other really rather horrible things. But he had the perfect face because he had this huge, great, doleful bags under his eyes, and he would turn up at these catastrophes. And whereas some, you know, if Grant Shapps turned up looking like an excited Springer Spaniel, it'd be somehow inappropriate because he can't help himself but be all sort of bouncy and happy. Whereas Paul Channon looked like an undertaker.
Yes.
He looked grave and serious and deeply concerned. And when he appeared at King's Cross Station after the fire, you just thought, yes, this man is genuinely troubled by what he sees.
Yes.
But he would have been just as troubled if his team won the cup final. That was just his, what do they call it? Resting bitch face. I think there's a special
expression I've
heard. He doesn't
look that. I'm looking at him on Google at the moment. He doesn't look quite as bad as you're describing him. But in fact, there's a picture of him as a young man smiling here. But he looks like a serious person, that's for sure.
Anyway, I digress.
You digress.
I was talking about the dominance of
roads for the future
as the infrastructure of choice, of importance, of matter in the 1980s and to a lesser extent. Well, then we had Swampy come along and everything started to change, I guess. To where we've come now, 35 years later, where roads are a minor afterthought almost in the national infrastructure assessment. They're basically saying that priority should be given to maintenance of what we've got. Any new infrastructure transport projects should be focused on inter-urban, either within cities, and they name particularly Bristol, Manchester, Leeds, and somewhere else, Birmingham probably. And the intra-urban is within the cities, isn't it? And inter is between them. The idea of roads between cities being built, long roads, is given pretty short shrift. And where there's a strategic case and it's part of a bigger, it doesn't say where they're going to build new towns with them, but that was kind of, I think, the agenda there. As far as the National Infrastructure Commission is concerned, it seems to me it considers the road infrastructure to be built. It's done. It's finished. Therefore, there's not a huge... I mean, you could argue that the A303 tunnel under Stonehenge is a strategic improvement of the existing asset. I don't think you can say that about the Lower Thames Crossing.
No, probably not. I mean, you mentioned the Stonehenge Tunnel and the A303. A lot of road projects now actually are upgrades, aren't they, rather than new builds. I can't think of a new motorway being built anywhere, or even when the last one was built. They tend to be up. I mean, my local A road's being upgraded. The A303 is being upgraded. There was the A14, famously, a very successful project. I think you're right. The infrastructure, road infrastructure, is there. It's just a matter of maintaining and improving it, whereas the rail infrastructure is slightly different.
You say that, but the Scotland and Wales have had fairly major... I mean, is turning a country lane into a motorway? I think that's more than an improvement. I think that is new road building.
Yes. Thinking about the heads of the valleys.
Well, Wales cancelled the extension of the M4, haven't they? And Scotland is the A9 something. Is it the A9 itself? But up in the north, links up there, have been... I don't know whether they've actually been scrapped or just put on hold, but I'm not quite sure what the status is there. But I think that the National Infrastructure Commission... only looks at things to which the UK government has got responsibility for. It's not looking at roads in Wales and Scotland, but it is looking at broadband in Wales and Scotland. That's my, off the top of my head, understanding. It is weird, the whole devolution.
Yes, because some things are devolved and some things aren't. Yes.
To be honest, it makes sense for the strategic road network, I think, which is, of course, National Highways agrees with me, might change its name from Highways England to National Highways. It does make sense for the strategic road network to cover the entire island of Great Britain.
Yeah.
But it's a political argument that I'm not going to win or even try and fight.
Well, anyway, John Armitt's report also recommends more spending on infrastructure, hardly surprising. And he says that...
he comes up with a figure, doesn't he? Was it 30 billion?
Yeah, 30 billion per year will be needed to... Well, he says the government commitment to increase public sector investment in infrastructure to around 30 billion will need to be sustained until 2040. And he also says that there needs to be more private sector investment, which currently is somewhere between 30 and 40 billion over the last decade. It needs to go up to between 40 and 50 billion in the 2030s and 40s.
So he's saying over the next, between now and when the Manchester HS2 station should have opened, we need to spend £1.2 trillion, £1,200 billion on infrastructure basically, between now and Manchester. And so suddenly that £32 billion for Manchester HS2 doesn't look that much, does it?
No, it doesn't, I suppose. No, put it like that. But of course, the question, the private sector, I suppose, private sector investment is one thing, but public sector investment means taxpayers' money. And he says that it should be paid for by the public via taxpayers and bill payers. And I thought, well, we're already funding, you know, the sort of the race to net zero through our energy bills. So soon, only a very small proportion of what we pay for our electricity and gas will actually be for the energy we're consuming. It'll be for the infrastructure that we're investing in.
Well, that's exactly the case. Already in the Thames Water bill payers are already paying for the Thames Tideway Tunnel.
Yeah.
This is the great misnomer of, we'll get the private sector to build. Then the taxpayer doesn't have to pay for it. Yes, taxpayer... The people,
the bill payers,
has to pay for it one way or another in the end, whether it's tolls over a bridge or your water bills or your gas bills or whatever it is. Private sector is only paying for it to make a profit out of it, and that makes it more expensive because the private money is more expensive than public money, and they're going to want the profit on top of that as well.
Yeah. And you mentioned Thames Water, and of course, all the other water companies will want to increase the bills that their customers pay because they've been told they need to invest in the infrastructure, and they say, "Yeah, we're going to do that."
But our customers will pay for it. Yeah, but that's to fix that's what it. They've already got. You know, all these vampire squids have been taking out gazillions out of our water companies not fixing the pipes. And suddenly you go, oh, well, you know, now they've had their 28 gazillion billion pounds. You bill payers have got to start forking out much, much more to pay for what we were meant to have been doing for the past 30 years. I mean, the whole water privatisation has probably been the biggest scandal of all the privatisations.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly hasn't worked very well. But is that enough infrastructure for one day, Phil? I mean, I feel I've had enough. I'm up to here with it. Should we talk about something else?
Yeah. Let's move on. What do you
Let's
got?
Talk about ladders, because it's that time of year again. In the autumn, it seems the Ladder Association always has a campaign. The Ladder Association is a trade body which represents, is it just the manufacturers or the distributors as well of ladders? Just ladders, basically.
Let's be clear, folks. It's not people who use ladders. It's not the Window Cleaner Association hosiery manufacturers.
The people who supply them.
It's, people are trying to sell ladders because ladders, since the work at height regulation, seem to have a bad rep. I mean, the work at height regulations don't say ladders are banned, but they do say, virtually, ladders are probably the last resort. Only use a ladder if you're just going to be quick.
Yes, and you should never work off a ladder, apparently, which will be
as long as you've done your full risk assessment and checked the alternatives, etc.
Really? Okay.
Although I've told you before about when I've got an area of flat roof about 2 meters by 6 meters on a corner of my house, and it needed refelting. So I got three quotes, as you should, and two of them said they're going to put up scaffolding and this is what it costs. And one said, I can do it off ladders and it'll cost you less. And I thought, well, I don't want someone falling off my house when I'm editing the Construction Index news service and trying to be a promoter of best practice. I better swallow the extra whatever it was and go for the cheaper of the two, who's going off scaffold.
Yeah.
So I went for him and he came. And the bugger did off ladders and said, I thought you were putting a scaffold up. And he went, no, we found we could do it off ladders. And I thought, so I'm paying for a scaffold and you're doing it. And I said,
So there, that's.
I thought that was a fast move. Should have had it in writing.
Definitely.
Anyway, sorry, the Ladder Association, David.
Normally they produce a very entertaining report, which is about idiots on ladders. I think we've talked about this in the past, we must have done. Photographs of people doing the most ridiculously hazardous things from ladders. You think of...
Quite creative sometimes, eh?
Things like putting a ladder in the front loader bucket of a telehandler or something like that to get the extra height. All sorts of weird and wonderful things. I saw a brilliant one recently, which is a three-section extendable ladder. And I've no idea how one person managed to actually erect it, because it must have been about 20 metres long. A man fixing or flaunching a chimney pot on an old house.
Whoa. What was that word? Flaunching?
Flaunching. It's the stuff that... It's that sort of... It's the mortar.
How do you spell flaunt? Is it F-L? Is it launching with an F on the front?
Yes, that's right, yeah. And we might have letters, actually, if I say this. But I think flaunching is the mortar, which is surrounding the pot on top of your chimney stack. And it's sort of it's battered down so that the rain comes off. Anyway, he was fixing a chimney, for God's sake. And he was literally on the top rung of this extendable three-section ladder, which with nothing below him at all. And I didn't see that this was a photograph, but unless it had been airbrushed or it was CGI, then it was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen somebody do on a ladder. But anyway, the Ladder Association, they've come out, they've done another one of these sort of like witch consumer group studies. They did one last year with telescopic ladders, which we did talk about, if I remember, where they went out sort of secret as a secret shopper and bought
the important thing is it's specifically the online stuff.
Oh right, yes, okay.
If you go into a shop, you're probably buying from a member of the Ladder Association, so that's probably okay.
Right,
but if
although I'm sure, yeah, okay, go on, carry on.
Well, so certainly this latest study was online. It's particularly okay. eBay, Amazon, whether you use the other Chinese sites, whatever they are, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
But their point, I thought the whole point was about, it's about being online ladders are dangerous because they're not going through a member of the ladder association.
Right. Okay. I'm sure you could probably buy one from a shop that isn't accredited to the ladder association, but maybe they're few and far between. But yes, you're right. These are on. And of course, you buy something online, you're buying sight unseen, so you don't really know about it. I suppose we should actually explain to our listeners what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about ordinary ladders. Last year, they were talking about telescopic ladders, which are quite useful for DIYers and tradesmen, I guess, because they fold down very, very small and they're easy to carry around in a van or store underneath the stairs or whatever you want to do with them. And they can extend to a reasonable length. But the trouble is, being telescopic, they're quite robust at the bottom. They get each section, and each rung is a section, is necessarily thinner than the last. So you end up with a very slender thing at the end. And they found that these things were buckling and breaking and, you know, really unsafe. And this year, it's a different type of ladder they're looking at. It's the multi-hinge joint ladders, of which I think we've established both you and I have an example.
Yes. Which so my, are these things? My mother bought for me online about 10 years ago for Christmas one year. So it probably is one of these dangerous. I haven't tested it to destruction. In fact, I haven't really tested it at full height because it's a four-section thing. You said yours can too. You can have the two outer sections vertical and the two middle sections horizontal, and it comes with some trays. You can make it into actually a work platform at about a metre height, which can be quite handy for hedge cutting or something like that.
That's exactly what I use mine for,
But, no, I would be slightly wary of using mine at full length to access a roof, simply because I'm scared of heights. I'm not going to get up that high anyway.
Yeah, don't blame you.
But I do use it to... I've got, in my garden, a quite steep bank, which is a bugger to maintain. In amongst the nice stuff is masses of bramble and nettle and weed and ivy and stuff. And so I have to prop it up the bank between the trees and bushes. I'm basically at ground level. If I fall off it, I'll just roll down the bank, which is not too bad, rather than come crashing down. Anyway, so what did the Ladder Association find when they tested these multi-hinge ladders, David?
Well, they found, they bought 10 of them, and they found that seven failed the required safety test. All of them claim to conform to the relevant European standard, EN131/4. So they had them tested independently. They bought these and had them tested independently by a UCAS-accredited test and research centre in Soham, which I think is in Cambridshire. And
Suffolk,
is it?
I think so.
Sorry. East Anglia, anyway. Sorry about that, Soham.
I'm going to double check.
Yeah, they failed. They're dangerous. They weren't safe, which is pretty alarming, really.
Oh, you're right. It's Cambridshire. Mea culpa.
It is Cambridgeshire. Sorry. There we are.
Sorry. Between Ely and Newmarket.
Right. There we are then. Anyway, so it doesn't really matter where Soham is for the purposes of this conversation. But, yeah, they had them tested and they found that they weren't compliant and were deemed unsafe to use. I don't know. I haven't read the report. I confess I've only read your story. I'm not sure what the problems were, what the safety problems were, but I suspect that the problems were
buckling,
confined mostly to these, was it to the joints, to the hinge joints, I'm assuming?
Mostly. They had some pictures, but the pictures seem to be mostly of the previous tests that they've done.
Oh, right, of the telescopic ladders.
Of the telescopic ones, yes.
Yeah, I mean, actually, an interesting point about that previous test was that they repeated it in April this year with the telescopic ladders. They tested them first last year, and then they repeated the test. They went out and bought 10 more, and they found exactly the same thing in April this year, that I think it with the telescopic ladders, it was 80% that actually were deemed unsafe. And when they did the same exercise again this year, 80% once more were non-compliant. So it's nothing's happened, basically. You still got those dodgy things out there. So I think clearly you've got to be careful when you're buying anything online, and especially if it's something which is safety critical.
Exactly. I was going to make that point. If it's safety related, that's the important thing. I don't think there's anything, you know, too much about buying, well, buy beware with anything. But with most things, they're easy to return. It's a bit of a bugger to return a ladder, isn't it? If you get a...
Well, that's true. Yeah.
You know, a pair of shoes and they don't fit, or you don't like the colour of them, or they're not what you thought they were going to be, you can just send them back.
That's right, yeah.
I suppose you can send a ladder back. But also, you don't know. If it arrives and it's got the stamp, the badge on it that says this conforms to standards...
How are you going to know?
Yeah, you don't know that it's dangerous until it fails. And then it's kind of too late.
Yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely true. So there's a loophole here because, and in fact, I'm not quite sure how this works, but a lot of this stuff which is bought online is actually bought overseas. So, I mean, it's not from a UK, not from a UK supplier. Does that mean that if you're buying one of these ladders on an internet website?
Are there any other thoughts of websites, David?
None that I'm aware of yet, but you never know. And it gets delivered to you, what, within three? I have bought stuff online which have come over from Europe, for example, and in fact China. What did I buy which came from China?
Something probably almost everything.
Electrical. Well, yeah, it might have been made in China, even if it came from France. But no, yes, something electrical, I can't remember what it was, came over from China eventually, and fine. And, of course, other stuff I've bought, which has come from the EU. But a ladder's different. I mean, what happens? I mean, is there an importer who has responsibility? I mean, if they say that, you know, our product standards don't apply outside of our jurisdiction. No, so if you're buying something from China, it doesn't have to, the manufacturer doesn't have to build it to British standards or to European standards. But surely somebody's importing that. Is it that presumably the importer is the customer? So
I guess.
So
is
there. So there's no third party who needs to demonstrate conformity with the prevailing standards? I assume there's not. It's all down to the customer.
That's a good point. And if if you're B&Q and you're selling stuff that has a standard to conform to, the trading standards could get involved. But if I tap on Tinternet and get someone to ship something from China straight to me, I don't think it's anyone's business but mine.
No, exactly. So
it's purely carrier emptor. It's not a case of trading standards need beefing up and more resources, which it often is in many of these cases. But no, in this case, it's just telling Johnny and Jenny Punter, careful what you do online there.
Yeah, exactly. Careful what you do online, which is pretty good advice, whatever you're doing online, actually. But yeah, so it seems to be, if that's the case, it's an insoluble problem. How do you get around it? I mean, the only way you could do it is that if presumably somebody has to bring it into the country through a courier service or something like that, either you make them responsible for it, but then it's really none of their business. They're not being paid to justify the products they're bringing in. They're simply transporting a product from one jurisdiction to another.
But there are a lot of people in this world who would argue that that's the way the world should be, a proper free market. And if I want to buy something from China, and, you know, whether it's some illicit substance or a ladder or whatever it may be, it's no one's business but my own. If I pay my money, makes my choice. And why should anyone say you're not allowed to do that, or that's got to do that, or you can't do that? It should be a free world, some say.
It's a fair point. I mean, I think probably if there's one takeaway from this story, it's if you're going to buy something like a ladder that you're going to be climbing up and is going to be responsible for your health and safety, don't buy it online.
No. Go into a shop, take a mallet.
Go to a shop.
And hit it.
Exactly. Or at least have a look at it. Look at what you're buying.
Do you think
Feel it. Try it.
Do you think you're allowed to go down to Wicks or Travis Perkins or something, say, I like the look of that ladder. Could you do me a favour? Could you just climb up and down it a few times to prove to me that it's safe? What do you think they tell you to do?
They'll probably say that, sorry, I'm sorry, sir, but I'm not allowed to do that.
I'm quite sure.
Which is probably true. They're probably not allowed to do that.
Not being on the course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's work at height. And if you're not trained to do it, you can't do it.
They'll have to get out a cherry picker to elevate the ladder.
Well, yeah. But one good thing is if you go to B&Q or Wickes or wherever it is, and you buy one of these things, and then you get it home and you take off the shrink wrap or whatever's it's inside, and you erect it and you have a look at it and you try it and you think this doesn't look safe, you know, it's rattling or it's flexing too much or something like that, at least you can put it in your car and take it back to B&Q or Wickes or whoever you bought it from and ask for your money back, because you've got your receipt and presumably you went to your local branch, which is only a few miles away. As you said just now, it's not quite the same if you're buying a ladder from someone in China. I mean, good luck getting your money back on that.
Yes. I was going to say, the money back is an issue. I'd say normally it would be a DHL or other courier companies are available. And the poor chap who'd struggled to deliver it would have to come back and pick it up. So it's not like you'd have to stand in the queue at the post office with your ladder.
No, that's true. But whether or not you get your money back is a different question. So anyway, that's ladders. Caveat emptor, I think, is the answer there, isn't it, Phil?
Absolutely.
Anything else you want to discuss before we wrap up for today?
I think we're just about done. We've fulfilled our 30-minute obligation. Now, I tell you, I do want to. There was one story I found was quite interesting, just worth a brief mention. The Tyne Bridge, beautiful, fabulous bridge up in between Newcastle and Gateshead, obviously everyone knows that, is on the point of being or is undergoing refurbishment for the first time in a while. Esh Construction has the contract. And we've reported before that they had to wait until the end of the kittiwake nesting season before they could start work on the bridge. And so they've done that, and so the birds have gone. And while the birds are away, they've got to build special sort of gantries and scaffoldings and things, bird boxes or something. They call them kittiwake hotels. when the kittiwakes come back next year, they have to stop work and all the kittiwakes come back and
they've got these ledges to nest on.
Because there are masses of these things. What's the figure of it? I can't remember the figure of more than 1,000 pairs. More than 2,000 kittiwakes, apparently.
That's an awful lot.
Live on the Tyne Bridge for parts of the year. Anyway, that was last year's story that we did, or 6 months ago's story that we did. This week's story. The Marine Management Organization, who is a government agency trying to look after, what it sounds like, waterways, seas, and it's not like the National Rivers Authority. So I don't quite know exactly. No. I know that they look after dredging licenses and things like that. So, but I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, Esh had to, or the local authority, the client, but I think it was Esh, had to get a license from the Marine Management Organization to do the work on the bridge as well. And they've now been granted this license under the condition that they're not allowed to point any lights directly at the river while they're working on the bridge. Because apparently if you shine a light into a river, now all the press release said is that it causes behaviour change among the fish and can impact migration required to spawn.
Yeah.
So I don't quite know how the shining... I mean, does your behaviour change under flashing lights, David?
Yeah. What do you mean? Do I spontaneously start dancing, for example? I don't know. I think the thing is, I think it's to do with migratory salmon and sea trout, because I don't know if you're not a fisherman, are you?
I'm not. I just eat the stuff.
I'm a very unsuccessful fisherman. I go out fishing. I never catch anything. But, you know, we've got coarse fish and game fish. Coarse fish are things like roach and pike and perch and bream and stuff like that. And game fish are trout and salmon. And some people...
Hang on. What makes a course fish course and what makes a game fish game?
Just coming... Well, because salmon and trout are prettier and tastier than, say, a bream and a roach. And so they're, it's almost an artificial sort of thing. In fact, do you remember the broadcaster Jack Hargreaves?
Yeah, who's on How? Who's on How?
How and Out of Town. He was a fisherman.
Fred Dinage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jack Hargreaves, I remember him saying that the distinction, the idea that, you know, there were game fish and there were coarse fish was a sort of apartheid. It was an artificial thing, and basically the gentry could have all the salmon and trout, and the commoners, you know, had to fish for the coarse fish, which are generally speaking less tasty than the game fish, it has to be said, although with the exception, I would say, of perch. But anyway,
conversely, game meat is less tasty than your lamb and your beef.
Well, not everybody would agree with you, Phil. I mean, it's gamier, but a lot of people say that makes it tastier. But that's beside the point. There is actually a biological difference between game fish and coarse fish, which is that they spawn at different times of the year. So it's currently the trout. It's the coarse fishing season up until, when is it? June, I think. I can't remember when the close season is for coarse fish. But the game fishing season, it's close season now. It ends at the end of September, and it doesn't start again until the beginning of March. So basically, game fish, salmon and trout, they spawn between, say, November and February, basically, and coarse fish between March and June. So clearly this is the middle of the salmon and trout spawning season, or is the beginning of it, and that's why Esh can't shine lights into the water, because you've got your salmon coming up the river to spawn in the upper reaches of the river, and if there's a barrage of bright lights there, they'll probably get put off and head out to sea again, and that's it, they won't spawn. The press release didn't explain it, but that's what I am assuming is the answer.
But Esh haven't been told that they can't shine lights on the river during certain months at all ever. So that suggests it's for all the your game and your coarse fish.
And your coarse fish. Oh, right, okay. I don't know. Well, I don't know. Whatever. Does that mean that nobody else can shine a light into the river?
Well, I suppose no one else would have an industrial light, unless complex on the Baltic, whatever it is, on the Gateshead
That's
side.
Right.
They might have some flashy lights that might shine, but maybe they all shine up rather than down, and maybe they know, or they've been told not to have their lights pointing down.
Funnily enough, because I had a look at this online, the Baltic Centre, which you mentioned, is a Baltic Centre for Contemporary Art, also has its own colony of kittiwakes.
Oh.
They nest on the Tyne Bridge and the Baltic Centre. And it's the furthest inland colony of kittiwakes in the world. I mean, this is just Wikipedia. I picked this up from. But that's
one of your internet websites?
Yes, one of my internet websites on the internet. That's right.
But if you can't shine, if shining a light on a river screws up fish populations and things, what about these, police search helicopters that you see on the telly when they're chasing bad guys down the streets and they've got their searchlight? Do they have to keep them off the river, or do they
I shouldn't think that the occasional flash of light is going to upset a salmon too much. It's probably if there's a continuous flood of light into the water, because remember, imagine that fish do tend to move around a bit more in the dark because they feel safer when they're they don't. Yeah, some fish do.
Can they see in the dark?
I don't think they can necessarily see in the dark, but they have a lot of other senses. You know, they've got their lateral line. They can hear and feel and sense and smell. And that's probably all they need, actually. But and one of the reasons why I'm an unsuccessful shore fisherman is that I can't be asked to go fishing in the dark. So... So I go out fishing off the rocks looking for bass and mackerel, and they're all out, you know, in the deeper water because it's daylight. Apparently they do come in closer to the shore at night. That's my understanding anyway, and that's my excuse for not catching them. But I think that certainly shining light into water does have a distracting or rather a deterrent effect on the fish. And so maybe they'd be reluctant to pass under the bridge if there's too much light in the water.
Well, there you go. I don't know if that's off topic or not, but I've learned something, David. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, what was that other word I learned today? Felching?
No, flaunting.
Flaunting. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, yeah, if anyone can tell David that he needs to know more about flaunching, podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. And we will be back with you again in a couple of weeks' time. But we've very much enjoyed our conversation this morning. We hope you have too. If you have, and you're listening on an Apple device, why don't you leave a review on that place where you can leave a review? If you've not enjoyed it, just keep quiet. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.